Hello, listener, and welcome to the next in my series of Mindful Meets. Little bit different today. So today I am joined by Simon Monkhouse, who is a consultant weight loss surgeon. Hello, Simon. You're very, very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Pleasure, pleasure. And a little bit different because this is the first time that we've discussed this particular area. And when I mentioned it to someone the other day, they said, well, doesn't that how does that kind of fit with what you do? And they weren't quite sure that they could see a correlation. But in fact, there is a very, very close correlation between having the surgical procedure and then needing that mindful eating element going on pre, post, alongside the whole journey, which we will get into discussing. So there, to get that sorted out to start with. So here we are. So Simon, you're a very, very busy chap. You've got a very active Instagram page where you put all sorts of educational stuff on, which is really interesting. And you're also making quite regular expert appearances on TV and radio to answer burning questions, aren't you? So thank you for sparing the time to
No,
chat
my pleasure.
to us today. So let's get going with something quite easy then. So your clinical background, and I'm quite interested to know, why weight loss surgery was a pull for you. What was the appeal?
Yes. So, basically, when I went through my surgical training, I kind of loved whatever I did. So when I did a bit of vascular surgery, I enjoyed that. When I did, bowel surgery, I enjoyed that. And everything I did, I kind of enjoyed. And I really didn't know which direction I wanted to go in. And I got a little bit more senior. We call it registrar training, which is the sort of 7 or 8 year training block before you can finish and become consultants. And when I, started my senior surgical registrar training. My first job was in bariatric surgery. And the consultant who was my mentor and my boss at the time was a very, very wonderful lady called Sally Norton. And she was an absolute inspiration to me. Just the way she interacted with patients, the way that she technically did the surgery, and how she embraced the whole multidisciplinary aspect to this specialty. And it was a real eye-opener because up until that point, surgery had always been about there's a problem, fix it, move on to the next. Whereas this specialty was there is a surgical solution to the problem, but that solution is only one part of the total solution. And it introduced multidisciplinary working, and it introduced me to psychologists, it introduced me to dietitians. And the way that she talked and empathized with patients was something I'd never seen before. And she just really inspired me, and I loved that job with her. And I stayed in contact with her for the rest of my ongoing training, and we worked together on projects and what have you. So I think I was malleable and I could have gone in any direction, but I had an inspirational mentor that just set my path. And I still think back in my mind, there was one particular patient I remember how she just totally understood the backstory, because often the patient is coming to you because they are living with obesity, but the reasons that they have the obesity problem are so complex and so multifactorial, and she was just able to break down those barriers and the traditional, the surgeon in the suit and the tie being, completely inaccessible to the patient was completely gone. It was just that first, surgeon and patient are two people on the same level just interacting, and that
Yeah.
was so wonderful for me, and that's really stayed with me throughout my career.
Yes. And so how long have you been a weight loss surgeon? How long, when was that?
So that was 2007, which was the start of my registrar training in Bristol. And I got my consultant job in Surrey, 2014. So I'm just coming up to my 10th year anniversary.
10th years, yes.
Yeah.
And you made a very interesting point just now, which was one of the areas that I really wanted to cover. So let's explore that now about this very complex nature of obesity. And actually, before we do that, so there's this word obesity. It's an interesting one because if you look at quite a lot of social media influence outside of the clinical arena, the word obesity is a no-go word. And I'm sure you've picked up on that. And I just wonder whether you have a take on using that word obesity. And if we don't use it, what else are we going to say?
Yes, absolutely. So there is huge stigma attached to the word obesity, and there is a real drive in the last, I'd say 5 years to reference this problem using patient first language. So they're not obese patients, they are patients living with obesity. And what has happened in the sort of scientific community is that it has been now very well established that obesity is a metabolic disease, and it is not a consequence of eating too much and not doing any exercise, although there are contributory factors, of course, but it is a disease entity in its own right, in the same way that things like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is a disease entity in its own right that has multi-factor causes and multiple solutions. So there is a recognition of obesity being a disease. It is a metabolic disease. I don't think we're going to be able to get rid of the term obesity, but we must not label people as obese patients, because that gives the it takes away the individual aspects of the patient, if you know what I mean. Is they're
It's
not just an
defining them rather than describing what they might be
exactly
experiencing or living with.
a patient living with obesity. They're so much more than just their obesity, and so we've got to drive, and patient-led groups are driving this for patient first language. But medical professionals are still stigmatizing. You go to your GP, and your GP might have not had any refresher training in this area ever. Certainly it's not a subject that's covered at medical school. I had no training in the metabolic disease of obesity or bariatric surgery in medical school. It's a kind of it's a modern thing, it's a new thing. So we're kind of learning as we're going. And the most medical professionals that the patients see don't have a clue about it. They don't have an understanding about it. And consequently, their advice is often wrong.
Yes. And I suppose in terms of this language, there's a parallel with neurodiversity in that we
Yes.
now wouldn't say you are autistic or you are
Yes.
ADHD. In the same
Yes.
way, in my area of overeating disorders, I would never say to someone, you are bulimic.
Yes.
So
Yes.
it's so, but I just thought I would also get that one out of the way as well. So this complex nature of obesity, then I think it's really important for people to understand so that they don't have an immediate negative judgment of someone who is living with more weight or excessive weight than is ideal for them, and not just sort of writing them off, because there are all these, as you say, complex conditions, factors which can actually lead to obesity. And I suppose then that would also answer that question of why do we need bariatric surgery? Is it not just a case of somebody changing their lifestyle? Can you talk a little bit more about the physical nature of the causes of obesity and actually why, for many people, surgery is the best solution?
Yes. So have you got 24 hours to spare? Because
I'm
this is a
sorry,
huge topic.
Simon. I know, I know. Well,
What
give us the highlight points.
I think the highlight concept is something called the metabolic set point. So your body is very tightly regulated for all sorts of things. One prime example is your body temperature. So your body is designed to have a set point for temperature. And if it goes up, like when you have a fever, you start shivering and shaking and it comes down. If your body temperature goes down, your blood vessels contract and you try and preserve your heat. So your body is trying to always keep at a set level for various things, temperature being one. And that's called homeostasis. And the same is true for your weight. And we've now discovered this, and it's called the metabolic set point. So your body is designed to be a certain weight. And that's why most people are staying a similar weight. They don't sort of have major fluctuations in their weight. But what happens if you are overweight for a period of time is that your internal metabolic set point jumps. So you become you get an elevated metabolic set point, and that becomes the new weight that your body wants to be. So we have so many patients who have experience of losing weight through extreme dieting, Slimming World, Weight Watchers, whatever you want to do, and they can successfully, very easily lose 5, 6 stone. The problem is they cannot maintain that weight loss. And that's because the moment you take away that extreme calorie restriction, your body is fighting you back to its elevated set point. So we have this sort of yo-yo cycle of people losing 5 stone, gaining 5 stone, and they just can't get out of that cycle. So what seems to be very effective is having a physiological reset to the metabolic set point. And the only ways that we have been able to do that in the long term appears to be through surgery. So there are lots of temporary fixes to it, like weight loss medication or dieting or anything like that. But these things don't result in a permanent resetting of the set point. Surgery seems to give us the best chance at a long-term reset of the set point. And most people think that surgery works by stopping you eating. And it absolutely doesn't work by that at all. It's a flawed concept. The surgery works by changing the hormones produced by your guts and your stomach. So by rearranging your insides or, removing a bit of stomach or doing whatever we do, that results in a change in hormonal profile when you eat. So when you eat, your body is producing a load of different hormones at different times in different concentrations. And when you have surgery, you turn that on its head. So your hormonal peaks and troughs are different to what they were. And that hormonal difference results in end organ effects. So your brain receives different signals, your taste preferences change, your appetite changes, your metabolism changes, your fat deposition and fat burning changes. The whole thing changes. So weight loss surgery is a change to your hormonal profile, which helps to reset the set point. And it is likely that in 10 to 20 years' time, we're going to have medications that do this well. At the moment, medications are just scratching the surface, and they tend to focus on one hormone. So medications tend to manipulate one hormone, but we know that there are at least 30 hormones involved in this sequence. So medication is exciting and interesting, but it's a million miles from where we're going to be able to use it successfully.
Oh, that's fascinating. So we're talking about leptin and ghrelin, amongst others here, are we?
Yes. And also, when people develop this sort of change in their metabolic set point, there are changes that are happening physiologically. And one of the things that has been really demonstrated by the scientists is that obesity can cause overeating. So when your set point has been changed, your drive is to eat. So your body is being told to eat, even, your fullness signals are gone and your satiety is all different. So obesity is driving overeating, whereas our concept is that overeating drives obesity. So the science is telling us that actually, once you are in that position, it's your condition that is driving you to overeat. So this sort of constant searching for food, getting up in the middle of the night and having to eat, searching for very sugary foods, is not because you're depressed or you're stressed. It's because you're being driven by your biological drives to do that. And it sets up a cycle. So when you are doing that and you are being driven to search for sugary foods, and you have something very sugary, you tend to have the sugar crash afterwards. And when you have the sugar crash, you feel rubbish. And you are getting into this sort of reinforcement of behaviors that then sets up the sort of psychological stuff afterwards. So biology then drives psychology, which then drives behavior. It's all linked, and that's why we cannot, in my specialty, we cannot be a surgeon in isolation. We have to work with, psychologists, eating disorder counselors, dieticians, the whole holistic thing, because it's not just one problem. It's a series of problems, but the basis of those problems is disordered physiology.
Yes, and hence the surgery that corrects that and resets. I like that
Yes,
idea. So
so it can reset the biology, but the behaviors that have been ingrained and practiced for so long need psychological
yes.
debunking and sort of getting back. So you have to have strategies to deal with behaviors,
Yes.
pre-op and post-op.
Exactly. Yes, because probably post-op, there's sort of too much happening all at once. So you've got to try and make some of those changes, as we discussed before we started recording, the mindful eating, the focusing, with my clients, I go back in order to move forwards. So I will look where those psychological eating triggers are coming from and what emotional support that eating is giving to them. And all of that needs to be assessed, doesn't it? So,
One of the saddest things I heard in my training, and it sort of stuck with me, is that a significant percentage of females who are super obese, which is our term for BMI over 50, so the BMI 60 area patients, a significant proportion of those women have had prior sexual abuse. And what the initial drive when you do this psychological analysis, what came out of that, and there was a study about this, is that the women wanted to make themselves unattractive to men. So they wanted to repel male attention. And as crazy as concept as that sounds, you can understand the sort of
Oh.
theory behind that. And then what
Absolutely.
happens if you then do surgery on somebody without going into that and exploring that? They lose weight and then potentially start getting more attention. And then those feelings can come back, and it can be a suicide risk. So
Yes.
there have been
At worst,
plenty of
and then
cases.
at least certainly self-sabotaging. Because of
Exactly.
this new situation that's been created, yes.
Yes,
Yes.
and so it's just so common. And that's why I'm so upset by the cheap surgery abroad thing, you know, the people buying cut price surgery abroad, because they're literally just having the surgery. There's no exploration of their psychological state, there's no understanding of their individual physiology, and there's no aftercare, and it's a disaster, an absolute
Yes.
disaster.
Yes. So I saw you pop up I think it was yesterday or the day before on talking to Jeremy Kyle about a balloon, I think. And I'd like to just understand more about the different procedures. And again, this is probably quite a long conversation potentially, but just could you just talk to us about the different ways that this surgery can be delivered and perhaps the sort of precursors or situation that actually needs to be presenting itself to you for each of those surgical methods to be appropriate.
Yes, indeed. So basically, we have surgical options and we have non-surgical options. And broadly speaking, the non-surgical options are the gastric balloon or weight loss injections. Now, weight loss injections we'll put to aside for 1 minute because they are very difficult to get hold of. There's a massive supply issue, and they are more in the sort of medical territory rather than the surgical territory, but it remains an option for people who don't want to consider surgery as an option. Then you have the balloon, the gastric balloon. I don't know, am I just on audio or is it visual as well? Because I actually have a balloon in front of me.
You can be on both, so I will put it up on YouTube. So Simon, do please show us your balloon.
Well, where's the other bit gone? Well, I did have one bit. Oh no, here it is. So
You can
basically,
describe
this.
it to us perhaps as well.
So the gastric balloon is basically a little pill, the
It's very
size of the
small.
tip of your finger. And what you do is you put that down into your mouth and swallow it yourself. So there's no surgical procedure involved in that. You swallow it down. The tube hangs out of your mouth. We put some fluid into that. And the little pill in your stomach expands into a balloon, which is a you know, fluid
Oh.
filled, very
And that's
heavy,
kind of about the size of a large paperweight. Yes.
grapefruit. So that
Grapefruit, yes.
what you swallow is a grape, and what you have in your stomach is a grapefruit. Since we're talking about eating, that stays in your stomach for 4 months. And the very clever technology within the balloon means that at 4 months it spontaneously bursts, and then you just pass it. So you don't have to have it removed or anything like that. But this is right up your street because this balloon does not do anything to your physiology or your biology. This is purely a tool to help you change behavior. So by having it in your stomach, you are forced to eat less and you are less hungry because the weight of the balloon in your stomach tricks your brain into thinking that your stomach's full. So you don't tend to feel hungry. And when you do eat, you eat less because it's physically occupying space in your stomach. So we take that opportunity during the 4 months that the balloon is in situ to work very intensively with our expert dietitians. And we also have digital technology. So there's an app and a tracking device. And now, actually, we have artificial intelligence in that digital technology, which can, you know, learn about you and give you tips and tricks bespoke to your own situation. So the AI side of it is very, very clever. But that's a training tool to in get it to result in behavior change. So it's
Yes, and over
not
that
a
4 month period, we would hope, we would expect that there would be, if there's consistent change, which the balloon is going to force, isn't it? That by the end of that period, that actually we would have retrained neural pathways and we've got those different thoughts and different behaviors going on.
Yes, and it is probably going to result in 12 to 15 kilograms weight loss, so 2 to 3 stone. So it's not going to be the game changer for somebody who is BMI 45, but it's just going to give you some training with regards to techniques about eating and how to eat, prioritizing protein and avoiding the processed carbohydrates and the sugars, etc., which will set you up well for the future, particularly if you're going to have surgery. Because what we notice very well is that if you don't do well with a balloon, you're unlikely to do well with surgery. So you need to have the same attitude to food with a balloon that you need to have with surgery, because you can out eat any procedure. So you can have a gastric bypass, which is our gold standard platinum level weight loss procedure, and you can out eat it. You can eventually regain all your weight back if you are determined to. So you have to use it as a tool. And the balloon is a very valuable little training ground to see how you do to do with it. Yeah, it's very good for that indication. It's also good for people who are not eligible for surgery. So, in the UK, we're very principled about who is eligible for weight loss surgery, and it's BMI 35 and above. So for that cohort of people between BMI 27 and BMI 35 who don't have access to surgery, the balloon is a very useful tool.
Yes. Do you
We
agree
try
with
and
that strict criteria about the BMI?
not at all, not at all. It's absolute throwback to historical times when surgery first came in, and somehow they had to ration the resource.
Yes, I thought you might say that. Yes.
And now it's just absolute rubbish. BMI is such a crude measure of the danger level of obesity. So, you can be BMI 29 and Southeast Asian and be very metabolically unwell. You can have bad diabetes, all the rest of it, because we know that there are cultural and ethnic and genetic differences between races, particularly the Southeast Asian population. They get ill from excess fat very quickly compared to more Western populations. We have this concept of safe fat. So you can be overweight, stroke obese, and healthy. You can. It's absolutely possible, because fat is stored in fat cells. And when fat is stored in your fat cells, it's completely safe because it's stored in your fat cells. You are born with a set number of fat cells, and they are not regenerated, or they're not changed. And if you exceed your capacity for fat storage within your fat cells, you start storing fat around your organs. And that is when it becomes metabolically dangerous. So you have fat in your liver, fat in your kidneys, fat around your heart. That is where it's dangerous, and it leads to disease. So fat in your fat cells and no fat around your organs, you're good as gold, no problem. If you have fat around your organs, you're in potential trouble. And the Southeast Asian population, particularly, I use that as an example because they're the more extreme example, they get ill from their fat storage capacity is very low, and they get ill very quickly at BMI 29, 30. So the BMI criteria for surgery is just utter rubbish. And actually, the international community has recognized that, and there are new guidelines internationally for weight loss surgery, but they are not they're not widely accepted yet, but they're out there. And what they've done is they've basically reduced the BMI criteria by 2.5 for different populations. So people can access it, but they're still fixated on BMI, which is.
And before we talk about the other procedures, how can we know where we store our fat?
Well, I don't suppose you can tell unless you have some kind of fancy body scan that would tell you. But fat on the outside is safe fat. So fat stored in your adipose tissue is safe. So women tend to carry their fat on the outside. So women have a relatively small internal body surrounded by, sometimes very large amounts of external fat, whereas men have a very small abdominal wall and don't tend to carry much external fat, but they carry a huge amount of fat on the inside.
Oh,
So
interesting.
men's livers and men's bowels are completely different to females in terms of the amount of fat distribution.
Oh,
So
it's fascinating.
it's technically much, much easier to operate on a female than it is to operate on a male. And just by coincidence, our surgery is predominantly female. It's 85% female, 15% male, probably because men don't acknowledge their health issues as much as
Yes.
women do. But that is fortunate for us mere mortal surgeons who need to operate on their insides. It's much easier being female.
Sure. So you mentioned the balloon, you mentioned the
Yes.
gastric bypass, that's your gold star. We've also got a
Yeah.
sleeve, haven't we, somewhere?
So the surgical options are largely in the UK sleeve or bypass. And sleeve is basically where you are removing about 80% of your stomach. So you're physically cutting out 80% of your stomach. And what that achieves is it reduces your big baggy sack of a stomach into a long thin tube. So you definitely feel fuller after a smaller quantity, but there are huge hormonal changes that happen by removing such a big amount of the stomach. So the ghrelin levels changes and all the other hormones associated with it. Also, the speed with which food exits your new stomach is quicker than it was before, and that sets up a hormonal cascade that's different to before. So the sleeve is a very hormonal operation, and it is very good, but not as good as the bypass in terms of weight loss. So I generally say to patients, if you want 6 to 8 stone weight loss, then a sleeve is, where you're probably looking at. If you're looking at 10 to 12 stone weight loss, then you probably need to think about the bypass because the sleeve is not sufficient to get you to where you need to get to. And what is very frustrating for a patient and a surgeon and the multidisciplinary team is if you operate on somebody with the idea of getting them into the sort of overweight range out of the morbidly obese range, and they stop losing weight when they're still in the morbidly obese range. That's not good for anyone. So you have to tailor your operation to the patient. But sometimes the patients come with such fixed views that they won't change their viewpoint on that, and that's absolutely fine. That's their choice. But there's a lot of stuff on the internet that people get fixated on, and they say, well, I have to have this operation because I've seen all this success. And you try and explain the pros and the cons, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Can I just
And
ask a
ultimately,
question about that point that you made about the fact that they may stop losing weight? So apart from perhaps that they're going back to previous eating behaviors, are there any other reasons why the weight loss might not continue as expected?
So that we expect people in general terms to lose about 60 to 70% of their excess weight. So we're not making people get into the normal weight range, generally speaking. I mean, that is an average, and people do better than average. And yes, you can get people going into that range, but we expect, and I think we expect sort of that sort of level of weight loss. And I think that's a reflection of where your new metabolic set point is lying. And your body wants to sort of settle at its new metabolic set point. Whether you get there or not will depend on a lot of different factors, eating behaviors, of course, psychological factors, of course. But interestingly, things like perimenopause can have an impact. So people who are going through menopause tend to struggle to lose as much weight as other people. So there are sort of competing hormonal interests going on in your body. So you have to be very realistic about what you are trying to achieve. And you know, we are not cosmetic surgeons. We are not, you know, the aim is not to make people look better. The aim is to improve their metabolic health and get rid of existing weight-related diseases, or to prevent weight-related diseases. So, you know, even if you stop losing weight at 4 stone down, that is still a significant metabolic improvement from when you started. So, you know, and there are lots of factors that mean that the weight loss is variable.
So the bypass then, I'm assuming it is how it is described, but just give us a little bit of the mechanic of that.
So the bypass is basically an operation on the stomach and the bowel. So unlike the sleeve, which is just an operation on the stomach. So what we do is we make a small stomach out of your existing stomach by cutting out a little pouch. And then we cut the bowel about 30 centimeters or so downstream. And then bring that bit of bowel up to the stomach and join it all together. So we're basically replumbing your anatomy. And what it achieves is rerouting the food away from the digestive juices. So when you eat normally, your food will be mushed up in your stomach and then go to your first bit of the bowel, the duodenum, and receive bile from the liver and pancreatic juices from the pancreas. And you will start breaking down your food at that point because the bile and the pancreatic juice are full of breaking down enzymes. So that's where you start your digestion, and by link to that, your absorption of calories. With a bypass, what we do is we reroute the food to later on in the bowel, so that the digestive juices don't meet the food until about 1.5 meters downstream. So you have bypassed a significant portion of bowel. And what that means is that you absorb less calories. There are huge hormonal consequences to that. But it's called excluding the foregut. You have to exclude the foregut to see huge metabolic change.
And how does that impact the absorption of essential vitamins, minerals, properties that are in our food?
So the foregut is where you absorb most of those things through the bowel, and so it is absolutely mandatory for bypass and sleeve patients, particularly bypass patients, to have supplemental vitamins and minerals which are absorbed earlier. Absorbed, so the tablet form or the liquid form are absorbed earlier on and go directly into the bloodstream from the stomach or the earlier parts of the tract. So they're not relying on food-based absorption in the foregut. And we do need to monitor the patients. You know, every year we need to do some blood tests. But with the sort of conservative bypass that we do here, the risk of nutritional problems is relatively no low as long as you take your multivitamins. As long as you're compliant with your multivitamins, you're not going to become malnourished. So the concept that the bypass is a malnourishing operation is not strictly true. It doesn't work through malnourishment. It works through hormonal change. And you can avoid malnourishment by taking supplements.
Thank you. And What would you say to someone who might be thinking that it's an easy option to have weight loss surgery?
Well, it is definitely not an easy option. There is a lot of work to be done, and it's a lot of ongoing work. So it is not a quick fix, and unfortunately, a lot of people think it is a quick fix. The results are very impressive in the first 6 months to a year, and they happen very quickly. So people sort of get into that mindset that they don't need to work with it because, look at me, I'm losing all this weight and everything's fantastic. That is the surgery working optimally and everything doing what it should. But what happens beyond the first year or two is you get what we call hormonal fatigue, and you get surgical fatigue where things are not working hormonally and absorptive wise as well as they did in the first year. So you have to expect to keep doing the work. Because if you don't do the work in the first year, you'll probably still get good results. But then you'll set up a whole sort of major problem going forward. So it's really important that you start doing the work early and keep doing the work. And we have this concept that food should be treated as fuel. So, you know, when your body is running empty, you need to give it fuel, and you need to give it decent fuel in order for it to function properly. And people say, well, what about going out for dinner? Am I ever going to enjoy going out for dinner again? And absolutely, the answer to that is you'll probably enjoy going out for dinner more, because before you were so focused on the food and the eating that you missed out on the conversation and you missed
Yes,
out on the lovely
exactly.
restaurant
Yes.
that you're in. So it's changing your focus away from food, and seeing food as fuel. And that's the work that needs to be done. And that does not happen easily. And that's where, you know, our lovely friendly psychologists come in, and do all their emotional behavioral work, which is so critical to this.
Yes. Now, your practice is down near Gatwick, isn't it? Yes, and that's
Yes.
so.
Yeah.
So is that predominantly private work now that you're involved in?
Yes. So the NHS, as you may see every time you turn on the news, is on its knees. You know, the it's just a complete mess. I have a full-time NHS job, so I'm in the NHS all the time, and it is on its knees. There is no funding. There, you know, things are falling apart. Patients are still getting good care because the workforce has a mission to provide good care, but it can't last forever. And what's happening is that resources are being cut. You know, no new spending because everyone's in so much financial difficulty. There's no new money. It's all recycling money. So weight loss surgery is one of those specialities that is always the first to get pushed to the side because it's not cancer and it's not emergency, and it's not considered by the funding people to be important enough, sadly, because again, you know, the stigma and all the rest of it. So waiting lists on the NHS can be up to 3 or 4 years, and you know, with all the strikes that happen and all the pressures on beds, you know, when they get their date, it's cancelled. So it's very, very frustrating on the NHS, and so people are seeking self-pay solutions. It's very rare for it to be covered by medical insurance, so it's usually self-pay, and unfortunately that means that people are also seeking options abroad, and you've got to be very, very, very careful with that because we know that regulations are not as tight as they are here. Equipment is not necessarily as good as it is here, and it's cheap for a reason, you know.
Yes, quite. If it's too cheap, then it's
Yeah.
probably isn't any good, and that sort of applies
Yeah.
as much to this as to anything else that you might happen to
But
see. Yes.
your listeners should, if they are considering weight loss surgery, they should always talk to their GPs about getting referred locally, because every region has its own funding. So it's called an integrated care board, and a group of hospitals in a region control their own funding. So the government gives that region a big pot of money, and then that region determines how they spend it. So there is a bit of a postcode lottery about whether or not you will be successful in being referred to weight loss surgery. And some places are better than others. So definitely, if you're thinking about it, see if the NHS options are available first.
Oh, that's really good advice. Yes, really, really helpful. And then if not, in the show notes, I will put all the information where people can get in touch with you to have your wonderful care. And I'm sure that there are several meetings that you have, conversations that you have in the initial stages, don't you, with people, just to make sure
Yes.
that it's right for them, because I imagine it's not right for everybody. And that
Yes.
might not just be about physical criteria.
Yes. Well, we have a multidisciplinary meeting once everybody's seen the patients to discuss exactly that. Are they suitable to go ahead? Because what the patient will tell me is not necessarily what they will tell the psychologist when they are, developing a relationship and opening up. So very, very often I will see a patient as suitable to go forward, and then our psychologist will come back and say, actually, they declared to me that they're actively binge eating and vomiting, and some red flags are coming up. And in that case, we absolutely go back to them and say, listen, this is going to be an option for you, but we need to address this first, and you need to be safe. And if you are binge eating and to the point of vomiting in the last 12 months, you are not safe to go through surgical procedures. So our psychologist is our absolute safety net, because she manages to draw out exactly what we need to hear.
Yes,
So
yes.
yeah, those meetings are vital.
And just one last question. Do you think that weight loss surgery is on the up? Do you think there are more people wanting it, and therefore do we think that obesity is on the rise? What's your overall take on the situation that we have at the moment?
Well, there is no doubt that obesity is on the rise, and 25% of the UK adult population are considered obese. 25%, so one in four. And you only need to look around you to see that's true. The worrying statistic is the childhood obesity, coming through the schools. And that's the really sad situation, because you know that an obese child is going to become an obese adult. So there is now sort of a quite a big push to try and help adolescent patients get out of their situation, and it is largely environmental, with obese children. They are literally being given too much of the wrong foods, in those environments. So the actual percentage of medically induced childhood obesity, so rare conditions, genetic stuff, that kind of thing that causes obesity in children, I think it's Prader-Willi syndrome is one of them. The actual percentage is very small. So the majority of childhood obesity is environmental, which then sets up its own psychology and its own problems, and you start disordering their physiology, and then they can't get out of their
Yes.
issue. So that's the saddest thing, because you see that more and more, and you know that that child has got a life ahead of them that it's going to be difficult.
Yes.
And access to weight loss surgery is still very, very difficult. Our National Bariatric Surgery Registry, which we kind of record every patient that is or we should record every patient on that's having a surgery in the UK, shows that we're only addressing about 1% of the eligible population. So in France, they operate, I think, on something like 12 to 13% of the eligible population. Other countries are much better. In the UK, we are terrible at offering or having available this service for the population. And Whether that's a failure of the state system, or whether it's just too expensive, or whether people don't know about it, or the stigma, there's all sorts of
Yes.
reasons. But
That's.
we could do better. But healthcare is a limited resource, and we can't do everything for everybody.
Yes, indeed. Oh, Simon, thank you so much. Gosh, so many areas that we've covered, and I'm sure answered very, very many questions that our listeners may have had. So thank you so much for giving up an hour of your very precious time to steer us through all of those areas.
No, my absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Not at all. Thank you. And so I will put all the details of the contacts for Simon, and also I might ask him for any other helpful websites that I can put on as well. And thank you, listener, for tuning in. And I will see you for our next Mindful Meets. You have a good day. Bye bye.